Good morning, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to today's Lockwood Lecture by Dr. Ruth. Do you pronounce it Yanai?
I don't pronounce it right. It's Japanese.
Yeah.
So when people say, how do you pronounce your name, I freeze. So in Japan, Yanai desu, hajime mashite. But in this country, people say Yanai.
Yanai. Well, I'll say Yanai and not the rest of it. I don't want to butcher the Japanese language. All right. Anyway, Dr. Yanai and I got in touch with Ruth as a result of the program director from the grant that I was working off of suggested that I contact her because of her work in quantifying uncertainty, which at first I thought, well, what are you saying about my data? But it turns out that it's a very, very important area of how we deal with the realities of collecting data and taking measurements, especially in the field, as Ruth will explain. Ruth did her undergraduate at Yale in geology and then followed up with a PhD at the Forest School in 1990. She did a Fulbright Fellowship at Edinburgh University in Scotland, did postdoctoral work at Boyce Thompson Institute at Cornell University, and then went on to her faculty position at SUNY, the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry, what many of us just call SUNY ESF. She's now a professor there still. She's been a visiting professor at the University of Tokyo and also did a sabbatical at Woods Hole. So we have that in common. I didn't do a sabbatical there, but I did spend a summer there doing research. Ruth is also a competitive track and field person, does master's track and field, or, yeah? Okay.
Yes. No, in my early years,
yeah,
as a master's athlete,
doesn't want to take ownership
athlete,
of that, but anyway, it's there for anybody to find out. Just Google it. She's also received at SUNY the SUNY Chancellor's Award for Excellence in Scholarship and Creative Activities. So today she'll be talking about why quantifying uncertainty is an important aspect of research for those of us who do field work. All right. Welcome.
Thank you, Bob. Bob warned me that I should speak to a non-specialized audience, so I'm going to try to relate this to why we should face our fears more generally. Does anybody want to guess why it would be scary to quantify uncertainty in ecosystem studies? I can think of a couple reasons, yeah.
Because there's a lot of uncertainty.
We could be afraid to find out that we don't really know what we're talking about. Any other reasons?
Because people could just dismiss your results.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
And I think the other reason it's been scary is because we don't know what we're doing when we try to do it. So you'll see some of the things we've tried for quantifying uncertainty. I don't usually like outline slides, but I'm going to do this because it's going to be four mini talks. So to quantify uncertainty in ecosystem budgets, for forest biomass, I'm going to illustrate the value of using uncertainty to find out where you need to make improvements. For precipitation, I'll give you an example of how to use uncertainty analysis for evaluating monitoring intensity. For stream flow, I'll be talking about how to fill gaps and how to quantify the uncertainty associated with filling gaps in a record. And for soil stores, I'll talk about detectable differences. And if I forget to ask for questions after each of these, interrupt me and ask questions. My case study is the Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest. I first visited it as a Yale undergraduate. I started working there as a PhD student. I've been working there ever since. Here it's shown in the context of the distribution of sugar maple. So our forests are not very different from what you have here. I think you have more species diversity than we do being further south. Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest is... the cool thing about it is, it was set up in the 1950s to monitor hydrology. It's in this, the northwest and southern borders are at the mountain ridges. They're not huge mountains, but you can see little headwater streams coming down. And if you put a weir on one of these little streams, it defines a little watershed. So there's 9 of these weirs on these little streams. Each of them defines a watershed, and you can start doing things like input-output budgets. Herb Borman, who was my major professor, had the idea that if you collected some water from the stream and the precipitation collectors and analyzed them for elements, you could multiply concentration times volume, and you could do input-output budgets for nutrients, for example, like you can for water. So then, and then they started doing these whole watershed manipulations. What if you cut it all down? So this one over here is the one that was being done when I started my PhD. Watershed 5, this is 4, this is 2. If you can still see, 2 was the first one that was cut down. And we're interested in things like what are the nutrient elements removed in a harvest? How is nutrient cycling affected by harvest removal? Where is the forest going to get the nutrients it needs to grow back? So my job for my PhD was to construct phosphorus budget for the undisturbed forest in the next watershed over to the one that had just been clear cut. And all I want you to see on this diagram is that there's a lot of fluxes and a lot of pool sizes, and none of them have any confidence associated with them, right? So plus or minus what? And I didn't know how to do it. It was troubled me for 25 years before I finally got a handle on how to do some of this. None of the ecosystem budgets had error. So this was the first, here's the first nitrogen budget for Harbor Brook. This is a monumental achievement, measuring the nitrogen in the trees and the soils and how much is falling in litter and being decomposed and how much is coming in from rainfall going out in stream water. And it didn't add up. It's missing 14.2 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year, and they called that nitrogen fixation. So 14.2 plus or minus what? And to answer that, I called this the holy grail, because to answer that, to assign that uncertainty, you have to go through all the parts. So I'm going to take you through all the parts. Where we get 14.2, this is simple math. This is just adding up the sinks and subtracting the sources. So the trees are growing, that's a sink. We need to estimate the nitrogen accumulating in the trees. Precipitation is an input. Stream water is an output. Soils change. So we're going to divide the soil into the forest floor and the mineral soil. For some elements, we would also have to take into account inputs from weathering. I'm going to ignore that. And in some systems, you'd be interested in imports or exports from animals. And I'm going to ignore that. Our most important animals are the insects. And then in thinking about uncertainty, this helps me. It's sort of a taxonomy of uncertainty. What are all the sources that I ought to think of? And some of these sources I had never thought of. On the left-hand side, natural variation, spatial and temporal. It's real. It's out there. It doesn't get smaller if we do a better job of measuring it, but we can better describe it with more confidence. And on the right-hand side, we have knowledge. So you measure something well or poorly. Models are a source of uncertainty. It's actually easier to describe model uncertainty within a model than what's the uncertainty in how you selected that model. And I'll give some examples of that. So we'll start with biomass. And I'll be focusing on model error, which is the most important part. When we need to know the nitrogen in the trees, we rarely cut them down and analyze them. So we're going to use a model. We're going to go out and measure the trees, and we're going to use a regression relationship to convert the tree, the diameter of the tree, to a mass. In this case, I have the mass of the leaves of a sugar maple tree. And it's pretty good as a log-log relationship. When Bob Whitaker cut down these trees in 1965, that's the way they did it. Now you'd probably use nonlinear modeling. And we can be interested in the... are there people in the audience who are good at regression stuff? Because I have some questions about this now. I'm working on a paper on prediction interval, confidence interval. Anyway, we're going to propagate this using Monte Carlo because it's so complicated. So there's a lot of these regression equations because we do it separately for each species and each tissue type. We need to do the tissue type separately because the concentration of nitrogen in a leaf is really different than the concentration in the wood, bark, roots. And we have thousands of trees in our inventory. So Monte Carlo is really nice because you could just crank through that equation a lot of times. You can crank through the whole equation a lot of times easily nowadays and interpret the distribution of the results. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change recommends this approach for quantifying uncertainty in carbon estimates in forests that are being used for international carbon credit trading. They say 10,000 times. Oh, wait, So the regression model has uncertainty in the prediction of an individual tree, which we're going to randomly assign to each tree, and uncertainty in the mean called the confidence interval. So as we step through the Monte Carlo, each step through the Monte Carlo, we're going to randomly assign uncertainty to each tree for the prediction interval and to all the trees for the confidence interval and do that 10,000 times. When I first did this, I like to say it was 25 years from the time I started doing an ecosystem budget to the time I figured out how to do this. I figured it out in Excel. It's not that hard, but you only want to press the paste button so many times. So here's 100 iterations of the Monte Carlo for the nitrogen, total nitrogen in the biomass at Hubbard Brook, and all the estimates are somewhere near 600. And I can look at the distribution of the results. So now I can get a confidence interval, 611 plus or minus 54. That's not too bad. It's less than 10%. That's the total contents of the biomass. And what I need for my budget is not the contents. I need how fast it's changing. So the accumulation was what I needed to get at my 14.2. So what I'm going to do is compare two time intervals. We measure the trees every 5 years. And we're in luck. If we're comparing the confidence interval, we're going to apply the same one at both time periods for each iteration. The forest has grown, so now it's 1997. We're up around 900. And the estimates are all over the place. But if I compare the 1997 to 2002, they're also all over the place, but if you look at each estimate, 2002 is always higher than 1997, right? So my uncertainty in the change is smaller than my uncertainty in the estimate. And if I look at the distribution of that, it's about 5 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. It's a 5-year interval. I'm going to divide 5 by 5, and I've got 1. So we're up to an uncertainty of 1 out of 14.2. due to my estimates of biomass. And I said I'd illustrate how this helps us, why we should confront our fear in this case. If I don't know where my errors are coming from, I don't know how to improve my answers. So this is what I did at the time I did my dissertation. All I knew how to do was a sensitivity analysis. I'll just vary everything in my calculation and see what matters the most. But it matters how much I should vary them by based on how uncertain each of those inputs is. I can look at the uncertainty in regression, and it'll tell me that my bark equations are worse than my wood equations. But who cares about bark? Most of the tree is going to be wood. So if in my Monte Carlo, I'm taking into account both how much biomass I have and what the uncertainty is in that, branches is the worst. Branches is bad. The equations are not great for branches, and the branches are pretty massive. So for both for carbon and for nitrogen, if I wanted to improve my estimates, I would cut down more trees for biomass of branches than I would for the stems or the leaves. So in terms of why we should face our fears, we don't know how to improve unless we face our shortcomings. And then I have a little cartoon for each of my parts of the ecosystem. For those of you interested in the technical aspects, measurement uncertainty is small for DBH. There's some other sources of measurement that are harder to define, like relocating your plots, identifying whether a tree is live or dead or what species it is. Spatial variability is, sampling error is usually higher than the uncertainty in measurement or models. And then choosing between models for forest biomass is huge. So if we didn't have our own trees that we cut down at Hubbard Brook and we were choosing which equation to use, that can be a much bigger source of error than almost anything else. So questions now on forest biomass so far or these approaches to uncertainty analysis? Bob, you want to say something about what if the trees are hollow?
That's what we're working on. So.
Yeah.
They pick the best trees.
Yeah.
Whitaker's equations are like suspiciously tight for 14 trees. And I asked somebody who knew him, and he said, did he cheat? You know, is this like Mendeleev and his peas? And he said he was really good in the field. He picked representative trees. Well, does that tell me how variable my trees are if he was truly good at picking trees? Yeah.
I'll ask one as a forester. It would make a difference just with sugar maple depending upon looking over its neighboring associates. So when you're looking at pure stands where sugar maple is going to have much smaller crowns, or a mixed species stand, especially up there, well, I guess more with paper birch, especially where sugar maples are going to have denser. I mean, that would seem to be a huge uncertainty.
And that may be why different people in different places get different regression relationships. So I can feel pretty good about mine because the trees that Whitaker cut down are from the same forest that I'm working in. But it matters if it's an even age stand or an uneven age stand and who it's competing with.
Going even further. I was just going to say the trees that you select really depends upon what their immediate neighbors are, like just how coarse the branch structure is and how dense it is.
Oh, and Jim Clark is interested in this problem. The errors are not random. So if you're growing next to a big tree, you're unlikely to be a big tree. So, yes, there's it's scary to do partly because it gets hard. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the precipitation piece of the story. John Campbell led a paper on uncertainty in input-output budgets at Hubbard Brook. And here, so it's a Monte Carlo again, and we're randomly sampling from a frequency distribution. Are you familiar with cumulative frequency? So we're randomly sampling from zero, evenly from 0 to 100%, and you can see that most of those samples are going to land near zero. So if this was written, if this was a frequency diagram, you'd see a peak close to zero for uncertainty in lab analyses. The lab people are great at this. Unlike ecosystem people, they always do standards, right? And they have a calibration check, and they'll tell you exactly what their accuracy and precision are for everything. So we have that. There are measurement errors associated with the precipitation gauge, and they are worse for snow than they are for rain. So blowing snow, how well does our precipitation gauge even tell us the volume of the precipitation that we're catching? When there's missing data, how much error does that introduce? I'm going to talk about that when we get to streams, but we have the same problem for precipitation. And then if there's a missing chemical substitution as opposed to a missing volume substitution, for precipitation, the chemistry substitution turned out to be a big one, so that's where we should focus some attention. And then the one I'm going to show you, because it's fun to show in slides, is spatial interpolation. So there's a whole bunch of precipitation monitors, but it's not continuous coverage. So if you want to add up how much water is landing in a watershed, you have to decide how you're going to interpolate between those points. And when this study was set up in 1955, they used T's and polygons because it's computationally simple. Every point on the landscape is associated with the nearest collector. You bisect the distance between every collector. So if you're doing a particular watershed, you know what fraction of that watershed is calculated based on each collector. It's just one lookup table and it stays the same. So now there's lots of other ways you could do this. I want you to watch the colors in the monitored watersheds, which are not changing very much based on inverse distance weighting, Krieging spline. I can use a regression model. We're very uncertain of the precipitation when we're far from our gauges, but when we're in those gauged watersheds, it really doesn't matter. So here's a bar graph showing those five methods. In the Monte Carlo, we randomly sampled for those five methods, depending on which watershed we're in, and it's always less than 1% difference my y-intercept would be way down below the floor. These are very small differences. They're small differences because we have so many collectors. So, people have been saying for a long time, 23 collectors, really? Do we need 23 collectors? So, this was an effort led by Mark Green, who's a R programming whiz. He calculated what the inputs are to the watersheds based on every possible combination of those gauges. So if we only had one left, this was for the south-facing watersheds, there's 11 gauges. There's 11 possible combinations for one gauge left. There's one combination for all 11 gauges. And in between, say we're going to keep four gauges, which is the answer we selected, there's 330 combinations of four gauges, starting with those based on 11 gauges to start with. Some are better than others, so we want to pick one of the ones that's better than others at giving us the same answer as when we had all 11. But even with a bad guess, we're only going to get an answer that differs by like 2%. So is it worth going around, especially in the winter, especially in the steep areas, especially where you might roll your snowmobile over? Do we really need to keep monitoring all these gauges? And I'm thrilled to announce that as of this fall, we are only doing four of those gauges and six of the ones on the south-facing slopes. So in terms of benefits of doing uncertainty analysis, we may discover that we have been overly cautious. Now, I'm going to say this in general, facing our fears. If we discover that we have been overly cautious, we could save time, save money by changing our behavior. Any questions about the precipitation issues or monitoring?
But I guess you're only going to find that out if you start with your overly cautious. I mean, you had to have all the sensors to make the initial test.
That's a good point. So how would you know if you started out with one whether you had enough? You'd have to at least invest in having some more to see. Part of what's fun about doing this at Hubbard Brook is they have been really compulsive about data collection for a long time. And I think they're overdoing it, and we have the information to see if they're overdoing it. Yes?
What is the normal variation on a 2 kilometer, what is it, the entire...
It's a very small area.
It's a very small area.
It's a very small area.
How much variation is there precipitation over that such a small area?
They thought there would be more. They had one gauge in the low, mid, and high elevation for each of the watersheds because they thought there would be more variation. Coweta is another experimental watershed set up around the same time for hydrologic modeling, and they had 150 gauges at one time, and they were able to see strong patterns in precipitation volume, so they created what they called isoplefs. It was like artesian polycons, but contoured to what they were observing, and then they eliminated most of the gauges, and they still use that map to calculate their precipitation inputs. Yeah.
Those areas are based on a whole year?
Oh, that's a good question. So we also did, if you do one storm at a time, then no, they're not that consistent. That was based on the long-term average. So we're very...
Not even annual.
I'll send you the paper if you're interested in this, because we've compared them also on a daily basis. How bad would it be if... It depends. I didn't say this, but choosing a monitoring design depends on what your objectives are. So if you really wanted to know about rain on an event basis, you might not be happy with this. If it's a thunderstorm, it's not going to hit all the collectors the same way. So we've also looked at month by month, and you can see certain types of storms, they're going to be more consistent from one collector to another than other types of storms. So if you know something about this, I'm going to ask you to be a friendly reviewer of this paper. There was one more question.
I was just wondering, you know, when you were showing the map, was that like a literal geographical map, or was it your polygon system?
Yeah, oh no, that's the map.
Right next to each other. I was wondering, like all the collectors, are those, is that the places they actually are?
Yes, because those six watersheds on the south-facing slopes and the three larger watersheds on the north-facing slopes are where these budgets are conducted. So that's where the collectors were set up.
Okay.
And there is too many of them. Yes?
Would you call it your sub-canopy or clear sky?
You have to have a 45-degree angle to the sky. That's another reason with having a lot of them and maintaining them. I'm shocked that when I want a tree from Hubbard Brook, they cut one down for me. Because they're always cutting down trees around these rain collectors. Don't tell everyone, but if you want to, there's fewer rain gauge clearings now that need to be maintained than there were a year ago. So I'm glad I got my trees when I did. I'm going to move on. Oh, I didn't get as far as my summary slide for precipitation uncertainty. So the measurement issues are not great for concentration, but there's some issues with volume because of how to collect precipitation. Sampling error, those watersheds are really similar. So from one to the next, the variation is 3%. But from one year to the next, it could rain or not rain. So interannual variation is high. The model uncertainty didn't matter because we had so many collectors for how to interpolate, and model selection error was tiny. Okay, so my uncertainty in my precipitation input is 1.3. That's actually based on a Bayesian hierarchical analysis that I didn't show you. But we're in good shape for that, and we're going to move on to streams. So once again, each of these little headwater catchments is defined by a weir, and you estimate the amount of water going over the weir by the height of the water, which is cool. There's a theoretical relationship that describes that, and it has like the density of water and the gravitational constant in it. It's really a theoretical relationship. And when they set these things up, they tested that relationship. So you put out a bucket, a big bucket, and you time how long it takes to fill, and you can see whether it departs from this theoretical curve. And you can see it departs, and so these correction factors were built into the calculations from the beginning. I meant to insert a slide showing what these look like, because nobody had ever graphed them. And some of them are embarrassing. I mean, they read these off. They probably drew a French curve, and then they read off some numbers and put them into these graphs, and they're crazy, some of them. And they're very small. They don't add up to much. So another change that I'm proud of is that there will no longer be corrections made to this theoretical curve. They're not important. What might be important, the only time you can go out and put out a bucket and check your theoretical curve is at low flow. Most of the water does not go over the weir at low flow in the summertime. The highest flows are snowmelt. And you can't use a bucket to check your height discharge relationship at high flow. So that needs to be done with like dye tracers or something, and the hydrologists are talking about doing that. Because if we really want an honest uncertainty estimate for our stream volume, we need to know how well this theoretical relationship holds up at high flow, not low flow. I said I would talk about gaps in the data record. So if you have a, I think this was a rain on snow event, and ice comes crashing down into the weir and knocks out your heater, then you're not going to be getting good height to calculate your discharge from. And I think it took 3 weeks for this to get repaired. So we have a gap, and we still want to calculate our nitrogen export for the year. Oh, this is, I said that I had worked with data from Coweta. Coweta has a lot fewer gaps than we do. And if you look at where our gaps are coming from, this is number of days per year. So the method is you have a float in the stilling basin behind your weir. There's a pulley system. There's a pen that goes up and down as the float goes up and down, and a chart recorder that turns based on a clock. I think the clocks were designed in the 1930s. So the clock is our biggest source of error, followed by like the pen is stuck or dried out or something. I mean, We've switched over. I think right now we're still running both systems, but the modern way to do it is with a pressure transducer at the bottom, and it's recording continuously and transmitting the information to headquarters, so you find out if there's a problem before the next Monday when you make the rounds to collect your chemistry sample. So big improvements, and there will be reductions in uncertainty. There will always be gaps. There's a gap when you have to clean out your weir. So when there's a gap, one way to fill the gap is by comparing it with a regression model to another weir. And I said they're very similar. One stream is much like the next, so you can do that. How do we then estimate the uncertainty due to having filled a gap? We can create fake gaps. So if we know the right answer and we pretend we have a gap, then we can fill it the way we would fill it and compare the real answer to the gap-filled answer. And as you might expect, we did this stratified by the duration of the gap and the rate of flow. So the uncertainty is higher at high flow and long gaps. And we used that to estimate what the uncertainty was in the water budgets. So all of that, we have a hydrologic export uncertainty of plus or minus 0.5. And my generalization for this, for the non-technical audience, would be you aren't really reporting your result unless you also report your uncertainty in your result. And we should do our best to do that even when it's hard. Here's my summary for the technical audience. The water chemistry uncertainty is small. Measurement and stage height, I didn't go into that, but that's small. Gap filling is small. Stream to stream is also pretty consistent, and year to year is not. And it's even worse than precip because the trees get their cut. So transpiration doesn't vary as much from year to year. And once you've subtracted that, you have a higher percentage variation in streams than you did in precip, which was already variable from year to year. So stream flow varies a lot from year to year. Model uncertainty, the height discharge calibration at most was 2% and closer to 0.1%, so we've abandoned that. And model selection, for precipitation, we had to worry about spatial interpolation of our collectors. Streams are a good spatial integrator. So we know what's happening at the weir. We don't care what's happening where on the watershed. But we're only out there once a week on Mondays collecting a sample. So we have to interpolate over time. And you can be more or less sophisticated in how you interpolate over time, and it doesn't matter very much. And the answer, once again, is because we're sampling so intensively. So I argue that once a week is probably excessive during the summertime at low flow, and maybe we should be putting more effort into collecting samples for analysis during snowmelt when things are changing fast. Oh, so questions, discussion about, yes?
Yeah, just one question on that. Is there a difference in, say, with nitrogen between high flow and low flow events within the same season? Concentration levels, so we have
some data? Actually, I'm surprised I know the answer to that. I think I do. This is not my field. Nitrogen does not have a very strong concentration discharge relationship. Some elements do, and some have higher concentrations at high flow, and some have higher concentrations at low flow. Somebody here know more about this than I do? You're nodding.
No, it just makes sense.
Yeah.
They read it diluted, whatever.
Yeah, and then there are additionally seasonal differences, like stuff happens under the snowpack, and when it melts, there's a nitrate flush in the spring. Yes?
Yeah. Behind your weir, you create a pool that has to come and measure it.
Yes.
Right. If one of Bob's trees falls down, that's going to change the calibration.
It's not
I'm saying that one of the
actually, one of the, causes of gaps, let me see if we can read it on this pie chart, is debris in the... Debris. It's actually small. So stuff getting stuck in the stilling basin. I think if a tree lands in the stilling basin, we don't care. Because It's the amount of the amount of water going through that V notch depends on the height in the basin. But stuff gets caught in the V notch, and that's what that tiny black sliver is for. All right, are you ready for the soils? The forest floor is the organic horizons above the mineral soil. We have a nice distinct distinct forest floor. We don't have earthworms that mix it up. We have spodosols that often have this nice bright white layer that makes it easy to find the bottom of the forest floor. So we monitor the forest floor because it's easier to do than measuring mineral soil. So every 5 years we have measurements for forest floor mass and nutrient content. This is another study that I did monitoring forest floors. We use a pin block to get an exact area of sample so that we can pull it out of the ground intact, measuring exactly 10 by 10 centimeters, trim it off to the pins, remove the mineral soil, measure it, bring it home, and analyze it. So this was going on every 5 years. Actually made a change and said, let's do this every 10 years. Maybe 5 years is excessive. And you can see that the nitrogen in the forest floor is not changing significantly over time. So you could put zero in there, which is what the original nitrogen budget had. But even if you put zero in there, it's not zero with zero uncertainty, right? So the uncertainty in that regression line is what we want, the standard error, the slope. The statistical program will spit that out for you. And the uncertainty in the slope is plus or minus 22. So we already lost our 14 with plus or minus 22. And I'll tell you it's going to get worse when we go to the mineral soil. It's a huge problem. It's a huge pool. So there's more nitrogen in the soil than everything else put together. And it's really hard to monitor it. So we're digging these quantitative soil pits. They're half a square meter, 0.707 on a side. Removing all the material, sieving it and weighing it in the field, and subsampling it to bring home for analysis. One of my grad students, who happened to have been a Yale undergrad, in one of our soil pits. And here's results for, this is a Hubbard Brooks study, not one I was involved in. Even when they divide their soil pits up by soil series, they're all indistinguishable statistically from one another. So 730 kilograms per hectare is not detectable with this statistical power. And then how do we get change over time, which is what we need for my budget exercise. In that poultry harvest that I worked in, they did pits in 1983. They did repeated soil pits. And dividing a very large detectable difference by the number of years, they came up with a decline of 54 plus or minus 53. So 53 is the number I have to put in my uncertainty budget. All right, and then the way you calculate, I don't have to Monte Carlo this is a sum. The variance of a sum is the sum of the variances. So if you ever need to do this, you just square each of those terms, add them up, and take the square root, summing in quadrature. So the answer is going to be 57. 14.2 plus or minus 57. All right, so bummer. One solution for the soils problem is to take more samples, because a lot of this is spatial variation. This is a gasoline-powered engine on a rotary drill bit, a circular drill bit. They use these for cutting through concrete walls, diamond-tip drill bit. And you can take a sample in an hour, where it takes like three people all day to do one of those soil pits done by hand. There's some biases associated with this, like you can go through rocks, but you can't go through rocks like the one you'll see in a picture coming up. So there could be some bias, but if you can get more values and the bias doesn't change over time, this might be a better way to get change over time with better precision. I worked with a physicist at Brookhaven who was developing a method that's non-destructive. So we were just chatting, you dig a soil pit, the very next day you dig a soil pit next to it, you're going to get a different answer. You destroyed the place where you want to come back and see change over time. So if you can take out a neutron generator, it's a tiny atom bomb, 10 centimeters long, that makes neutrons, and you monitor the gamma radiation coming back out, there's characteristic energies of gamma rays that interact with these elements in the soil. And so we took this out to one of our plots, and we could detect theoretically a 5% difference, and it takes an hour to collect this spectrum. So he was working on making a more portable version of this device. So I wanted to go into how you calculate a detectable difference. Nobody should just say, we didn't detect a difference, it's zero. We need to know what the confidence is on that zero. So it could be zero because it's really, really small, or it could be zero because your ability to detect a difference is crap. So you do a power analysis. This is an example done with forest floors. And if you have if you can pair your samples or your locations, your plots over time, you have more power than if they're independent. And then you can say, how many samples would I need if I wanted to detect a difference of 20%? That's pretty feasible. Difference of 5% looks pretty... So a difference of 20%, if I'm paired and I'm lucky, I might be able to get that with just 20 samples. It could be worse. And if I'm expecting a bigger change, then I can get away with fewer samples. So you might want to do that analysis. I've done this analysis for root biomass. You might say, if we can only detect a change of 20%, let's not measure every 5 years. We're not expecting that much of a change to occur. So it's another way to inform sampling designs. So sampling designs, I kind of already said. I'm going to say we can plan for the future. Power analysis allows us to plan for the future based on what we know already. And my summary slide for soils is measurement uncertainty is terrible. That's a rock that you couldn't have sampled through with any other method than a quantitative soil pit. And the spatial variation is terrible. So one piece of advice I have is to change your question. If we black box the ecosystem and exclude the soils, then we have really good confidence in our 14. I still don't like the 0.2. But 14 plus or minus 3, we know there's a missing source. We just don't know whether it's coming from the atmosphere. They called it nitrogen fixation. We don't know whether it's coming from the atmosphere or the soil. But if I exclude the soil from my calculation, I can say with high confidence it's coming either from the soil or from the atmosphere. That's my last little lecture, so I'll finish and then we can have general discussion. So value of uncertainty analysis. I talked about uncertainty and regression. I talked about Monte Carlo, which is pretty easy now with big computers, how to calculate detectable differences with a power analysis. And then the benefits, why we should face our fears. We can figure out where we should be putting more effort. We could figure out where we could be putting less effort. I didn't update this bibliography, but you can get any paper I ever wrote from my website. And better yet, we have Go Back. And my name is unique to the internet. So if you can remember my last name, if you Google Ruth Yanai or Yanai, you can find me. And this is a little harder to find. Quest is not unique to the internet, but so our website is quantifyinguncertainty.org. Quest is already taken. This is a research coordination network funded by the National Science Foundation. We are supporting publications and papers in this area. Bob's might qualify. We have everybody's code is up here, so you can get examples of how to do this. There's you can follow us on Twitter. I'm afraid we don't tweet as often as we should. We're sponsoring special issues and journals and promoting collaboration among scientists. Thanks. Okay, so questions about the soils issues or any other questions? Yes?
In doing the chemistry for your overall nitrogen budget, you've got the rain coming in. Where's the dry deposition component? Do you have a dry deposition component of it at all that you tried to monitor?
I would have to flip back through a lot of slides to see if that was in the big nitrogen budget. I think they have, people have worked on that, and it's small, and I think they include it, but just as a fudge factor. But don't quote me on that, I'm not sure. And that's another source of uncertainty, huh? Yes?
I couldn't help but notice, but you don't have any microbial contribution in the soil.
Well, that could be what they're calling nitrogen fixation.
Right. Yes, it seems like that.
Denitrification. I didn't tell you this, but back in 1965, there was a missing nitrogen source. Now there's a missing nitrogen sink. And that could very well be denitrification. But since the soil pool is so uncertain, we can't tell you if it's denitrification or if it's just an accretion of the soil pool. So that's a good comment. In the back.
Yeah, you used the term fear in your title to talk, and then people let us sort of feel this. Here. Is there anything that strikes you that you can't do with the modeling? Or would you ever say the modeling is wrong, this can't be done?
There are a bunch of things still that I don't know how to quantify the uncertainty in. So I'll tell you all this one, and maybe one of you will think of something. It's really simple what we do when we take a weekly stream concentration and multiply it times a weekly flux and add that up for 52 weeks. What's the uncertainty in that sum? Mark Gein tried randomly sampling the 52 weeks. No, that's not uncertain. We know there's a lot of stream flow in March and not a lot in August. That's not a source of uncertainty. There's no replication. I think this is one of the reasons it wasn't done. We're doing an ecosystem budget. There's the usual way we quantify uncertainty is to do it a few times and see how different the answer is, right? So you have, that's what sampling error is. When you're doing a watershed and you get one answer, is there no uncertainty with that? I heard Bill Schlesinger once say that when you do a global carbon budget, there's no uncertainty because there's only one planet that we're doing it for. I hope he was joking, because we really, really care about what our uncertainty is when we do these global calculations. We don't need a replicate Earth. We're not going to be able to rely on a replicate Earth to get the answer. So when you say what's still scary, there's still a lot of things I don't have a clue how to do.
I guess the global warming.
There's uncertainty in all the global models, and then there's four different climate models, and you can compare them. But guess what? They all left out clouds. I mean, I'm a decade or two out of date when I say that, but none of them include clouds. Well, you know what? It really keeps the heat in at night when you have clouds, and it lets the heat doesn't go out in the day when you have clouds, and none of them have clouds. So that's an uncertainty in model selection problem. Even if you propagate the uncertainty in the models, if you thought you could ignore clouds and you didn't. I mean, we think we can ignore herbivores. How do we know how important that is after we've already ignored them? Over here.
So I have sort of a non-specialist question about, like, what is the scope of this quantifying uncertainty in ecosystem studies, the big project? I have worked a lot in the past with organic farmers who are really interested in soil carbon sequestration. Uh-huh. And I've visited salt marshes where they say the carbon sequestration in the salt marshes is greater than any terrestrial system. And so I hear all these people making big claims about how much carbon sequestration could be in different systems. And it seems to me that a lot of these claims actually conflict with each other. So I'm kind of wondering, what is the scope of this project with all these different kinds of ecosystems? And to what extent are these different people talking to each other?
Well, that's a good question. There is one paper on our website that does uncertainty in a ecosystem budget for a coastal, I think it's a marsh system, and it's terrible because the inputs and outputs are so uncertain when you're communicating with the ocean. So the scope I had in mind was, we had to think about the scope. There's lots of people working in uncertainty in all areas. NEON is the National Ecological Observatory Network. They're spending a lot of money in a lot of places trying to collect data in consistent ways, and they are committed to having all of their products have uncertainty associated with them. So there's a whole bunch of people working on the sensor uncertainty and the calibration uncertainty, and there's a lot of people working on these problems. I think when you get up to the ecosystem, then there's some additional challenges. But you might find something useful here. There's I don't think we have any organic farming examples on the website, but if you have some, send them along, or send your colleagues here and see if they find it to be useful. But these approaches would work for any system. But yes?
Yeah, I was just going to say, for a general audience, it seems that this is a real call to do pilot studies beforehand. Mm-hmm. And on forest sampling, when we're trying to get timber estimates, you actually go out there a lot of times to do a pre-sample, see what your error is, figure out how many samples you got to go back and redo it. But I don't know how many studies, I think it's not in here, you're saying you should almost put in a pilot study, find out where your uncertainty is, and then concentrate your sampling for the full-blown project to minimize those uncertainties.
There's a mindset, at least at Harbor Brook, and I think this is really common, that once you start measuring something, you have to do it exactly the same way. And so it's been really hard to get people to think about, do we really need all these collectors? Do we really need to do it every week? So having a more adaptive management approach to what can we learn from what we've got, or you're saying even plan ahead. And if we had in mind that this was just a trial and we were going to design based on it, we wouldn't have so much resistance to changing the path we've been on. The long-term record. People benefit from these long-term data sets, right? And then they're afraid to do anything going forward that would change what to the research community. I'm happy to talk with anyone after this, so thanks very much for having me.
Please join me in thanking you.